Broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn, you're listening to heritageradionetwork.org.
Today's program has been brought to you by the Heritage Meat Shop, located in the historic Essex Street Market in New York City. For more information, visit heritagemeatshop.com.
Well, hello, and welcome to Chef's Story. This is Dorothy Cann Hamilton, and today my guest chef is none other than the fantastic, fabulous pastry chef, Pichet Ong. For those of you who might be outside the New York area, you might not be as familiar with his name, Pichet Ong, but let me just give you a little bit of a lineup of who this guy is. First of all, he has been named by Star Chefs as a rising star way back in 2002. And then he came up and he was in 2005 named one of the 10 best pastry chefs in America by Pastry Art and Design magazine. In 2005, he did a dessert at Spice Market called Thai Jewels that just blew Adam Platt's mind, and it was named one of the favorite desserts of the year in New York Magazine. The one I love, his accolade I love, is in 2004, he was named the Pastry Provocateur by Food & Wine magazine. I mean, I can go on and on, but I think one of the most honored things you must have received in your life, Pichet, was in 2011, you were honored by the Museum of Chinese in America with the Legacy Award for Outstanding Achievements and Contributions to the Legacy of Chinese in America. I can't wait to start talking, and I will welcome you by saying Sawadee Ka.
Sawadee Ka, Dorothy. Very honored to be here.
Oh, it's great to have you here. Let's get right into your background, because we just spoke a little Thai there, and your background is, even though you're Chinese, your background is in Thailand. Why don't you tell us where you grew up and how you got into pastry? And
My parents are from China, and they were both born in China. They met in Thailand, where I was born, in let's just say in the ballpark of late 60s. And I grew up in Thailand for the first few years, let's just say in the early 70s. And then I went to school in Singapore, where I got I guess the British school system, got my O-levels, and then I came to the States to go to college. I studied math as an undergraduate, and then I went to graduate school in Berkeley, California. I finished with a degree in Master's of Architecture. And that was around the time when computer became important in design. And it just wasn't for me, because in school, I was discovering the process of making something with my hands, and I've always enjoyed that. Even before, at home, we made breads. I helped my mother with whatever cooking that needs to be done for the family and my aunt. I knew that that was
something. So you mean computers drove you out of architecture and into the arms of cooking?
Yes.
That's the best thing I've heard about computers in a long time.
It's just not me, to be sitting behind a desk and pushing buttons. I'd rather get my hands dirty in making something.
Okay, well, we'll get to that in a little bit. But I want to go back into your childhood.
Okay.
Because you are not only a pastry chef now, you're just one of the country's top pastry chefs, but you're a savory chef as well.
Yes.
And let's go back into your childhood, because the concept of savory and the concept of sweetness in Asian cuisine is so different than Western cuisine.
Yes.
And the balancing. So what was your palate like as a young man, and how did you become one of the great Western pastry chefs in that profile changing?
Well, I always consider myself to be someone who was born to eat. I love eating. So you can ask my mother that. Even at the age of 4, I was eating quail, and I was eating frog's legs and anything you can find in like one of those Chinese restaurants that have like a crazy menu. I always enjoyed fresh fruit. My mother told me I never ate anything that's out of a jar. So even with baby food, I was eating fresh fruit purees. I've always like had an adventurous palate. It's not so much that I seek out like strange things to eat, but
So the desserts in Thailand when you were very young, mm-hmm. like kao neo mamung.
Yes, kao neo mamung.
Yeah, is the sticky rice and the mango.
Yes,
it's very very sweet.
It's very sweet. But
so did you have that sweet palate?
I did, but you know the one of the secrets to kao neo mamung is also a little bit of salt that they put in the coconut milk that's draped over the rice. So that sweet and savory combination is something that's very typically Southeast Asian. Mm-hmm. And it's something that has always been my main profile flavor combination is sweet and savory.
So did you go to a lot of restaurants when you were young?
We did. The other thing that I do with both my mom and my dad, who got separated before I was born, was that we got to know each other and bond through culinary vacations.
Really? Where
yes.
would you go?
We went to Japan. I think that was the first trip that I remember really fondly. When I was 7, I went with my dad, just the two of us, through Japan. We ate our way through Japan. And with my mom, it was more like the Philippines or Indonesia or India. She also has an adventurous palate. Well, at that time.
Uh-huh. Well, that's pretty adventurous.
Yeah. And then we started going to Europe when I was in my teens. And, eventually when I moved to the States, they flew over here to take road trips. We drove cross country from Boston to Miami. And a trip it was from Montreal to Vancouver. And we just ate our way through the country.
So when did you really start tasting Western cuisine versus Eastern cuisine?
At a pretty early age. We were going to, in Bangkok, we ate at Normandy.
Normandy at the Oriental
yes,
Hotel.
That, yeah, before John George was there.
Yeah. And that's the French fancy restaurant,
right.
The top hotel. Yeah.
Right. Ironically, like 15 years later, I worked for the man.
At Jean Georges.
At Jean
yeah.
Georges, yeah.
Yes.
There were other, continental cuisine that was around in Singapore as well.
Because for me, there's a real seismic difference mm-hmm. in the Eastern palate versus the Western palate.
Yes.
In regards to savory, bitter, use of sugar,
yes.
And also spice, which we really don't have in the West, the
yes.
heat, you know. So how do you calibrate your mouth? Do you when you eat Eastern food, is it an Eastern mouth? And when you eat Western food, is it a Western mouth? Or do you have a fusion mouth?
I just have my own mouth. I have to say I do have a sweet tooth and I do seek out sweeter profiles in food. Just actually when I have Italian food, I notice a lot of things that I like in Italian cooking is sweet. And even in French, there's a lot of caramelization of vegetables such uh-huh. as onions and carrots, let's say.
Uh-huh.
When they're overly roasted,
right.
Which is the way I like my vegetables to be cooked. It has a very sweet profile that's almost dessert and candied, like, you know, sweet potato, rutabagas. I think that's what I like in cooking in general. And
so this title of pastry provocateur, mm-hmm. I'm going to kind of dig down a little later in the show of where that came from, because you're a very individual, very unique pastry chef, you know. And but let me get back to, you got to this country by coming to school. You went to college. And
yes.
What about architecture that appealed to you?
Well, it was college that brought me here. The first time around when I came to the States when I was 14, was to finish high school over here and then go to college. What drew me to architecture was the fact that I was undecided as to what I want to do. I like a little bit of science, which I was really good at. I like a little bit of social studies. I like history, and I love art. And I love art studios, sculpture, drawing, and anything that's three-dimensional. And when I was looking through academic programs, that what drew me into architecture in the first place is you have a little bit of everything. And at that time, my father also happened to be in the business of real estate development. And I thought, okay, maybe I'll finish architecture school and then work for my dad. You know, I was you know, 16 and young and bright-eyed, and I wanted to, you know, have some kind of stability in my future. Uh-huh. I mean, I saw that coming, you know, which is the Chinese in me. Uh-huh. And I thought architecture made the most sense at that time.
So where did the bridge to cooking come in? Professional cooking.
I think working with my hands, I think I wanted to continue doing that. And I've always loved food. You know, first and foremost, I was actually a customer on all these restaurants that I was going to. And in the end, my first job was at Chez Panisse, where I was a customer. And it became like a free internship.
So how did you get into Chez Panisse? Because you had no cooking background, professional
I was a very
background.
Good customer.
And so you said to Alice?
Yes, you know, can I have a job? I'll do anything, peel vegetables, squeeze lemons, whatever.
So tell us about that.
And then there was a job. And then...
how long were you there?
Not very long, because at some point, you know, the practicality in me said, I got to find a way to make money. And then I went to... La Folie in San Francisco, which was my other favorite restaurant in San Francisco. It's very small, chef-driven, Roland Passo, the chef.
Yeah.
And it's I knew that that was a kitchen where I can learn everything fast and the hard way, because I'm learning directly from the chef, from the man himself. So he put me on the dessert station, and you know, I had to figure out how to make mousses and custards and pat brisé.
He didn't show you? What, did you read books, or how did you do it?
I read books, Joy of Cooking, Julia Child, La Notre.
So he let you run the pastry kitchen pretty much, or do that by learning out of a book and being and having the product come out okay?
Well, we started out with a chef. There was a pastry chef, and then you know how things move.
Hey, folks, you're hearing the real deal about what goes on in the back of a restaurant kitchen. So wait, so you started out with a pastry chef, and
yes.
Then the pastry chef obviously left.
Yes, and then I took over, and at that time I was also working the Garmager station, you know, learning how to...
in addition to the pastry?
Well, you know, it's long hours. It's 12, 14-hour work days. I got to figure out what to do with that time. I can't just be making pastries. It's a small 50-seat restaurant.
Right.
And Garmager was a big interest of mine because I love salads.
Right. So that's appetizers and salads,
yes,
Garmager.
And
yeah.
Terrines and pâtés. You know, and in French cooking, that's really, really important. And that one I learned directly from Roland. And, you know, it was his passion as well. And I thought, you know, this is a great way for me to learn French cooking.
So where was your DNA going this time? Was it going to savory or was it going to pastry? Was it sweet?
Well, it's hard for me
as a professional.
It's hard for me to decide. I love eating desserts. But I also enjoy eating savory foods. But I tell you what, I do love the way I smell after working a full day of making cakes and pastries. I can't say the same if I were to be cooking meats or fish.
That's true. Okay, well, we're going to take a little break here, and we're going to come back and really get into pastry provocateur.
Okay.
Message from the Heritage Meat Shop.
Are you tired of just hearing buzzwords? Do you want to actually take part in the food revolution? Then come on down to the Heritage Meat Shop, located in New York's historic Essex Street Market, on the corner of Essex and Delancey. We have rare breed pork, beef, poultry, lamb, and goat, not to mention charcuterie that'll make you squeal. All raised right, by the right people, so you know they'll taste right. Try the meat that over 100 New York chefs ache for. Come to the Heritage Meat Shop and pick up some revolution today.
For more information, visit heritagemeatshop.com.
Well, welcome back. This is Dorothy Cann Hamilton, and you're listening to Chef Story. And today my guest is none other than the great pastry chef, Pichet Ong. We've just talked about your childhood and background, but I really want to get into your professional life. And I, you know what, I also want to point out you were Phi Beta Kappa in English literature and mathematics from Brandeis. I mean, you've got both sides of the brain going there. So, you know, great pastry chef has this architectural mathematical ability, but you also have this other artistic ability. Well, going through your background, I'd like for our listeners, for you to tell me about the journey, because you did start at Chez Panisse and then went to La Folie in San Francisco, but in New York, you worked at Tabla, Jean-Georges, Sono, Cello, which was incredible, Oretsky's Patroon, some of the top restaurants, and then you did a large stint with Jean-Georges at 66 Spice Market, Perry Street, and then, like every chef, you've gotten into your own restaurants, and you've had a few. And we're going to get into your latest one, which I think is the most exciting. But why don't you tell us what that journey's like? I mean, does every chef want a restaurant? Is it what you expect it to be when you have a restaurant? Do you stop being a chef and start being a business person? What's that journey like?
Well, I feel like it's been a journey that span over a long period of time, which is over 20 years at this point. I guess I'm giving away my age, but that's okay. But it also happened really fast for me. As I was saying earlier, in California, I felt like the responsibility of being a chef fell on my lap really quickly. First, I was responsible for the desserts in the restaurant. And later on, when it became something that I was sure that I was going to do and have my own business, it became a huge responsibility also in my lifestyle and with my family, my parents, because it took quite a bit of explaining to do. I have a master's degree. I spent a lot of time and money in education, and somehow it's just not being carried through with a career. But then when I look back at it, I mean, every point in my life has meaning, and I think at this point, you know, I'm drawing what I learned at school into my business.
So when you started, you had the passion of food. Now you're in the back restaurant, really learning under fire how to be a professional chef. Then you go to someone like Jean-Georges and go through multiple of his restaurants with more and more responsibility. What's the difference from working in the back as a pastry cook to when you become the pastry chef? What's that seismic difference?
Well, I think I happened to also find a chef that was actually, I consider myself to be a fortunate chef in a way that I found support in the right environment. Like, for instance, with Jean-Georges, it is obvious that we have very similar taste in food. And I think that's important, and something that I tell young cooks that comes out of school at ICC or whatever school, that it is important that you look for things that connect you. And for me, Jean-Georges has a passion for Asian food, and I have a passion for continental food, French in particular. We both somehow believe that there's a merge somewhere. And the key importance is that we both communicate well. And we both like that sweet, sour, salty, bitter profile combination. This is way before the media or food writers even pick up on, you know. And I think that's has to do with timing and the right communication. So I always tell young cooks to look for that when they start out their career.
So when you were working with Jean-Georges, did you always work the pastry side, or did you ever work the savory side?
I actually started out as a line cook, because there was no pastry.
So savory.
Yeah, there was no pastry position offered to me when I first hit the pavement in New York and hit the door at Jean-Georges. And so I started out being a fish cook at Jean-Georges, the first team.
Wow.
Jean-Georges.
As Jean-Georges, the four-star.
The four-star in Trump.
Yeah,
this
Trump.
Was when Wiley Dufresne was there and Gabriel Coiter, you know, all
oh
these
my gosh,
amazing
what
chefs
a,
were there.
What a class of chefs.
It there. Was an intense time.
Okay, so did you always want your own restaurant or your own shop?
I don't know about restaurant, but my own something. It
yes.
could be a bakery. It could be a catering company. It could be writing. Okay. I always wanted to do something that was me.
So your first one was...
My first one was Pong.
P-star-ong.
Yes.
Yes. Tell us about that. And was it what you expected? What were the things you expected, and what were the things out of the blue that you didn't expect with that first venture?
Well, we started off well. I managed to raise money to open a restaurant. And at the time, economy was good. And
What types of people you raised the money from?
I started asking money from, I guess the first round of people that I approached were my customers or fans, if you call them. I mean, people were interested in what I do and supporting my future or the future of, culinary.
Right. And seeing your profession, your style get out there. Did you actually get money from those people?
Yes, I got money from those people.
Wow.
But on a personal level, I also put up my apartment as collateral to get some money out of that. And I went to my parents, although that was a last resort, because they've already, paid for my college education.
Right.
They've done enough. And, I managed to raise enough money for the restaurant to open. And then we opened and we had a good run for the first couple of years. And then, this was in the late 2008.
Yeah.
The economic economy. Downturn happened. The economy got worse. And we ran out of money. But we also expanded fast. I opened up a bakery next door called Batch that drew all my resources. But I was also going through a really hard time. My mom had a stroke. I was going through a personal divorce from my relationship. And Yeah, it was a lot of things that came down all at once, and I wasn't prepared for that.
So how do you close something? I mean, what kind of personal toll does that take on you?
Well, I mean, the very first thing that you have to decide was to stay open or close, and it's like pulling teeth. It's like one clean yank. It's something you got to do. It's painful, but you got to do it. And so I decided to close it, and then I closed it. And then
how did you feel like a month after?
Well, the very first thing I felt was like a sense of something that's just lifted, and then a month later you just go through the paperwork and, you go through a whole long, painful process of cleaning up. And then the jobs came, the second round of people showing support came through, and I went through a series
of jobs.
And where was
that? Where did you go after that? What was your first job after Pong?
Well, I went back to John George, and he was very kind enough to offer me consulting position since... I've moved on in my life and my career. I've established a name. It didn't quite make sense for me to go back and work, although it was also there at the table. But I did consulting, and I also started work with Max Brenner.
The chocolate guy.
The chocolate guy, yeah, by the bald man. And we revamped the menu and rolled out more Max Brenner, Boston, Las Vegas, Philadelphia. And that went really well. And then I worked with a cruise ship, Holland America.
Wow, you got a lot of good consulting gigs.
Yes, I did. And it was good while it lasted. And eventually I knew that I had to find a home and rebuild my myself as a chef again.
Yes. Why is that a burning desire inside you? Is that, that you have to fulfill yourself as a chef? Consulting, even working with food in that level wasn't enough. What is it deep inside that makes you want to go back into the fire?
Well, I wanted to, I've always been a sort of, I know that I like to do many different things, but eventually I like to stay focused on making one thing and making it really well. That's always been something that I believe in as a chef, is at, looking at your entire career, you have to be remembered, or you have to have like something that, is
a signature
to you. And for me, it's always been getting the right sweet and savory combination in dessert, and crafting the making like something simple like chocolate chip cookie, let's say. And during the whole time I was consulting, I was also keeping in the back of my head that I'm looking for an opportunity to create a business It could be a shop. It could be a wholesale business selling my products.
And your signature.
And my signature products.
Yeah.
And so now I've found it at Sugar and Plum.
Okay.
Yes.
So we're going to get into Sugar and Plum, which is just fascinating. But how did you make that transition from consulting? I mean, to say, I think I want to go back into business. I think I want to. I know that you want to do your signature work, but did you do it differently this time? Did you go about it differently?
This time is a little bit different. First of all, when I had my own shop, I was doing everything. I was cooking. I was serving. I was keeping the books organized, like the financial books, QuickBooks organized. I was cleaning the restaurant, washing dishes on certain nights, opening the door and closing it, turning off the alarm.
How many hours a day? 24.
24, because, you know, I answer all texts and calls in the middle of the night. Sometimes the alarm services would call like at 4 a.m. and say, somebody just broke into your restaurant. You know, it was just constant. And I don't have any regret. I mean, it's all part of the experience of being a chef, and it's something that I had also wanted to go through. But this time around, we have a team, which I think is very important, and I think that's another formula that has been successful with many chefs.
So how did you put together a team?
I actually didn't put together a team. This opportunity came around through a friend of mine, Ed Rosenthal, who we met when he was working at Star Restaurant Group at the opening of Budokan in Morimoto. And, you know, we've kept in touch this whole time. And, you know, I know it took a long time, but now, you know, he and I, our team, and we have a few more people. This, you know, accountant and investor and a bunch of cooks and my
so you chefs. Have business, you have business partners, and you get people from skill sets so you can concentrate on what you do best.
Correct. And what the accountant does best and what Ed does best. And
right.
And the PR. I mean, it's just a whole system.
Okay. So structurally, tell us about Sugar and Plum and what it's, because it's not one dimensional.
Sugar and Plum is a company that had started about a little short of a year ago. It was a startup being a commissary that provides desserts to a store in Paramus. And then they also do wholesale that they sell to hotels and catering companies and restaurants. And, you know, thus far, it's been doing quite well. And when they were looking to expand and open up retail outlets in New York City, they had approached me, and I went through the whole process of interviews and communication and tasting, and then finally I joined the team a few months ago, and now we're just working hard to get the store open. It really looks like it could be open tomorrow if you actually visit the store. The first one is at 78th and Amsterdam. It looks like it could be open tomorrow, but I need all cooks, so
okay.
So please send me resumes.
Yeah, so send resumes in
and counter people
and counter. Okay, so you're recruiting here.
I'm recruiting.
All of you. Do people need experience?
Well, considering I didn't start off with any experience, I'm willing to train for the right.
I want to see how many people are going to be. Talk to Jack here, Jack Inslee at HeritageRadioNetwork.org, and we'll see what we could do. Well, we're going to take another break here, and we'll be coming back in a few minutes, and we're going to delve into what you're going to do at Sugar and Plum.
Okay. Thank you.
back. This is Chef Story, and I'm Dorothy Cann Hamilton, speaking to the great pastry provocateur, Pichet Ong. And we just ended the last segment by talking about his new venture, Sugar and Plum. And it's a big commissary that actually provides desserts to hotels and restaurants. And if you're lucky enough to live around Paramus, New Jersey, they've got a shop out there. But you're going to be opening now in Manhattan. And that's a whole different kettle of fish, I would imagine, than a commissary.
Yes, I think so. And I'm very comfortable. I mean, I think I do have a following.
I know you have a following.
Yeah. So Upper West Side is not quite my territory, but I think, you know, because of the neighborhood, it is something that's much needed in the neighborhood.
Now, it's going to be more than a pastry shop bakery. Isn't it going to be a bit of a restaurant? Why don't you tell us what the concept is?
Well, it's going to be a restaurant bistro, more of a bistro and bakery cafe type. You can come in any time of the day. The type of food I would characterize it as being comfort everyday food. You're gonna have your Caesar salad, your sandwiches, mac and cheese, steak, beet salad. I mean, things that I love. And and the chef Stephen Ferdinand does really well.
But you have to leave room for dessert, because that would be a big reason.
Yes, that
to
is
go
the
there.
Policy. Everybody must get dessert, even if it's something that's like a fruit tart.
Okay, so anyone visiting New York or lives in New York, I have to say you have to go up to 78th in Amsterdam after, I think it's August 15th, you're going to open?
Around there,
mid-August. Because, you know, when Adam Platt went gaga over your desserts in New York Magazine, it was because he called them Thai jewels. It was the Thai jewels that you had on Spice Market's menu, right?
Yes.
And your desserts, more than anyone, I think, look like jewels. Tell us where your visual eye comes from, and you know what you're trying to do with your desserts.
I've always been a fan of anything that's kind of sparkly and bright. you know, bling is always in for me. Not that I can, you know, that I look good in them or can afford them, but I do like enjoy looking at shiny new things. I mean, I you know, I do like the idea of food being a thing of beauty, and it doesn't necessarily mean precious. It could be like a simple pizza that I think is charred and beautiful, and you know, you take a moment to look at it and then you eat it.
Right. So how big should a dessert be? Should you have a huge piece of cake?
No, absolutely not. I think dessert is something that, I mean, in my culture, I grew up eating dessert anytime. My dad is one person who whose eating habits I learned from. I mean, he would just eat dessert at any time, most often actually the first thing in the morning, like as soon as he hits the kitchen.
And he has something sugary.
And, you know, it's also a very European thing as well. You have like a little croissant or like a piece
of chocolate.
You know, anything that's sweet. I think it's a nice way to start off a day. And then also something you could have in the middle of the day. It doesn't necessarily have to come with a meal or at the end of a meal. But even in Thai food, you see that, you know, many people have like curry and then they have like a bowl of shaved ice or Nam Kang Sai, you know, like a Thai jewels like thing,
right,
to clean their palate throughout the meal. So I don't have this set notion that desserts have to be had at the end of the meal.
Really? So would you incorporate in an appetizer or in the main course sweetness?
Absolutely. I mean, at Pong, I had many appetizers that had like a sweet component to it. I was putting sorbet on ceviche, which I think makes a lot of sense.
Ooh. So is any of that going to be done in Sugar and Plum?
Not sure. We're still working out the menu. We actually have another round of tastings this afternoon.
Ooh.
But I think it's a really cool idea. I mean, you're beginning to see a lot of that in most chef-driven restaurants is pastry technique in dishes. And appetizers are a great way to show off, you know, what possibilities there are in cooking.
Is there a difference between a savory chef and a pastry chef?
Well,
technique, mentally, intellectually, you know, like, is there a different way of thinking?
I mean, to answer that kind of quickly in a sentence, most pastry chefs have OCD. And most chefs are kind of, you know, free and floating. But I think in general, there's a bit of precision that's involved in pastry. I mean, I think they teach you that at school.
Yes.
And I think the program is, you know, in baking is a little bit more structured.
Yes.
You go through steps and it's kind of a progression.
Right.
You know, the basics you must know. And here are the possibilities where it can go. In savory cooking is a little bit more open, right?
Yes.
And I think in a career, I think pastry chefs tend to have also step-by-step the process of, you know...
Measurement is very important.
Yes, it is.
Yeah.
But, you know, I kind of think like a chef. So in a way, when I come up with plated desserts, for example, I do tend to pull things from everywhere. So it's a pinch of this and a pinch of that. Which essentially is also very Asian in a way.
This is the Phi Beta Kappa of English and mathematics coming together. It's so Asian in having different flavors coming together, not necessarily just at dessert.
Or, yes.
Yeah. Yeah. So tell me, with sugar and plum, tell me some of the dishes. You were showing me these ice cream sandwiches. Tell me... Describe for our listeners that you're going to have to go. I'm getting this blueberry coconut combination. Go tell them about the ice cream sandwiches.
Well, the ice cream sandwiches that I made now on sale at Paramus is you know, it's something that, you know, came out of because of, you know, the seasonality calls for it. And so you know, being in New Jersey, I like to use local berries, and so I make a berry ice cream, and then I cover it with coconut taquas, you know, for that crunch, and, you know, to hold the sandwich together. Mm. And then I also have a caramelized banana ice cream that has a milk chocolate caramel cake that, you know, to sandwich it together.
Oh.
It's something I actually collaborated with my sous chef, Tina, who, you know, is a big fan of ice cream sandwiches as well.
You know what? I have a cousin, Joni, who lives out near Paramus. Joni, get me some. Bring them into the city, or I'm going to drive out there. But we're going to have Sugar and Plum on the Upper West Side.
And also Bleecker Street.
And Bleecker Street, too. Tell us about the Bleecker Street.
Well, it's going into the space where Murray's was before they moved to the new location.
Uh-huh.
It's small, and it's going to be a little bit different in vibe than Upper West Side. You know, Pong was in West Village, and I think it's... you know, I've lived in New York for 15 years, and West Village is where I feel most comfortable in terms of the neighborhood, and I don't live far from it. So I think the Bleecker store is going to be very personal to me.
That's interesting. So these aren't cookie cutter stores, pardon the pun, but the West Village store is going to have a different feel than the Upper West Side?
Yeah, but because I think the neighborhood is a lot more eclectic, and I think it's going to be a venue for me that I can express Sugar and Plum doesn't just have one, you know, dimension to the look.
Okay, so tell us about some of the desserts. I saw the pictures, and we're going to put them on the website here, so you could go to them. The marshmallows blew my mind.
Well, it's going to be a little bit more rustic in West Village, and so certain products is going to reflect that. But it's also in the style of service. It's going to be more to go as opposed to a place to sit down. It's going to be a little bit less polished. It's going to be a different aesthetic altogether.
But describe more of the desserts that you're going to be selling, the cakes,
okay.
And tell them about the marshmallows.
Well, the marshmallows is going to have different fruit flavors, that also reflect the season.
The colors are absolutely vibrant. I mean, you could put these on a platter and serve after dinner on a hot summer afternoon.
Yeah.
And they are spectacular looking.
Yeah.
That's where these jewels come from, I think. And the pastry provocateur in your cookie pops, you know, okay, ladybug. You do have the ladybug cookie pop, but you have a hippopotamus that's outrageous. It's incredible.
Well, they certainly have an appeal to kids, and I think it's always important to have for desserts to be fun. I think when they look fun, they look a lot more appetizing that way, and I think kids will, you know, enjoy looking at them and playing with them before they eat it.
But tell people why you started the cookie pops.
Well, I think I like the idea of using up all ingredients, like all, you know, every part of the, I mean, in savory cooking, it's very in right now, like to use every part of the animal. I don't see why that cannot be applied in baking. I mean, when you make a cake and you make any kind of entremets, there's always trimmings that that just sit there, and it's kind of sad for me to throw them out. And I think for a cake pop, which mostly is consists of cake trimmings and leftover mousse or ganache, you put it together and you form a pop, and then you decorate it, and then you give a new life to something that otherwise would have been thrown away.
What's the outside icing made of?
It's usually dipped in chocolate, but sometimes it also has pieces of sugar, fondant, to decorate them. We also have a whole line of puddings, which are like soft cake textures in a glass that are also made from trimmings. And I think those are a nice way to sample a flavor, you know, a dessert flavor combination at sugar and plum.
What's your opinion of chocolate and the role it has in a dessert menu?
Well, I think chocolate is, to me, I look at chocolate as a natural drug. it's addictive and it's supposed to be good for you. But the most important thing is that it makes you feel better and make you a happier person.
Well, who could argue with that? So what's your favorite chocolate dessert that you make?
Well, it depends on the seasons. I do like warm chocolate in the winter time, and I do like cold chocolate all year round. So I'm a big fan of ice cream, semifreddo, but I also love chocolate bonbons. I mean, I eat them all year, chocolate bonbons. I love that soft custard texture of chocolate.
What about cakes?
Oh, I also love cakes. I think one of my favorite right now that I have on the menu is a chocolate caramel cake. Chocolate and caramel combination is killer. And that's the secret to candy bars. I think the reason why candy bars are so addictive is that combination of caramel, salt, and chocolate.
Oh. And, so tell us how you do your cake.
Well, it depends on the recipe. But in general, like for, I like my cakes to be kind of light and airy, moussey, giving you the impression that you ate a lot of chocolate and a lot of flavor for the least amount of calories. And so the cakes, my cakes tend to be lighter, like a light chocolate sponge and with a light mousse and coated with a rich chocolate buttercream that will give you that intense flavor. But, you know, in a warm chocolate cake, it tends to be a little bit heavier, but then the portion is also smaller. I think moderation is one of the secrets to eating these days.
Always.
Yeah.
So we're coming to the close of the program, and you have just such a rich past, and you're a real cerebral chef. You have tremendous... there's a lot of intellectual heft in your desserts when you see them, not just in the visual, but even in the flavor profile. What would you share with young chefs out there today who want to be Pichéong?
I want to say that it's very important for you to a young chef to think about your role, not just as a chef, but what do you want to contribute? Like, what do you want to be? I think it's important to, I mean, not decide, but have an idea of you know, where would you like to take food? And I think when you start off, you know, off working, you know, find a situation where you're going to benefit from, not just as a chef, but also for, you know, your career. And I think I tend to attract the kind that wants to have a business, like a small business, or you know, belong
to
a corporate structure, or
yeah,
a signature. And
yeah,
I think it's important to think about that. I think it's something that actually a lot of chefs have, and I think pastry chefs perhaps not so much, but I think it's changing because you see a lot of young pastry chef entrepreneurs these days.
You do?
Yeah, I do.
Well, I want to thank you so much. This has been fascinating. And if I can say, Kopkun Maikai. And we'll see you next week.
Yes.
Bye.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our programs archived on our website or by searching iTunes for Heritage Radio Network. You can find us on Facebook or follow us on Twitter @heritage_radio. You can email us at info@heritageradionetwork.org.
Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website. Thanks for listening.